إن الحمد لله نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا من يهدي الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلن تجد له وليا مرشدا أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله صفي من خلقه وحبيبه والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين محمد المصطفى وعلى آله وأصحابه أجمعين. Today we are going to talk about a hero who really has influenced the minds, the thoughts, and the ideologies of the major mujahideen around the world. Okay? The major mujahideen and those people that are striving hard in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala against oppressive regimes. The hero that we are going to talk about today, if you ask them, they will say that they have been influenced directly as a result of this man and his writings. If you ask, for example, Sheikh Abdullah Azam, he would say that the person he was most influenced by in his life was Shaheed Sayyid Qutb rahmatullah alayh. And that's why it's very important that we understand his life and his works and what effect did he have on the society and how is it that his thoughts influenced and permeated society. We'll begin with his background and his family. He was born in a town in Egypt, near Asyut, called Musha. And it's a difference of opinion about, you know, his family, his great-grandfathers, whether he was of Indian origin or whether he was of Egyptian origin. But his family, you know, his immediate family were well off, mainly because of the large inheritance that they had received from their grandparents. But that inheritance, of course, was gradually decreasing as Sayyid Qutb and his family were leading their life. His father was a man who was highly respected in the community and was seen as a central figure and also a political figure that they would go back to settle their disputes. And he was also a very practicing man. What we realize about Sayyid Qutb is that his family were a very practicing Islamic family from the very beginning. And Sayyid Qutb, his father, would take him every time to the masjid. He would pray 5 times salah in the masjid at that time, and his father at that time also managed to do hajj, which is quite an achievement at that time because it was very difficult for people to go to hajj and it was very expensive. Sayyid Qutb says about his father these very important words: he implanted in my senses while I was a small child true fear of the last day. You know, this was implanted in the heart of Sayyid Qutb. And if anyone has read Fi Dhilal al-Qur'an, in the shade of the Qur'an of Sayyid Qutb, and they read the tafsir of the verses about the last day, they will realize what these words are and the effect that his father had on the life of Sayyid Qutb. Not only his father, but his mother was also highly respected and also highly pious. And her two brothers, the uncles of Sayyid Qutb, they were Azhari scholars. And she was a woman who would generously give to the poor and the workers that would work in their field. She would always listen to the Qur'an, and the lasting impression of Sayyid Qutb of his mother is that she would listen to the Qur'an on the radio while looking at the workers on the field. And so his mother was very adamant that Sayyid Qutb, he doesn't grow up like an ordinary child, just plays around and gets involved with the amusement of life, but she wanted him to grow up like a man and therefore would shun him from many of the childlike activities. If we just have a look at the brothers and sisters of Sayyid Qutb to realize the greatness of this family that he came from. He had, excluding himself, three sisters and one brother. The oldest sister was called Nafisa. And let's just have a quick look at what happened to her. Along with Sayyid Qutb, she was tortured, and with her two sons as well. Her two sons, one was called Rifa'at and one was called Azma. Rifa'at, okay, the nephew of Sayyid Qutb, was tortured and beaten and killed in front of him. While Azma, the other nephew of Sayyid Qutb, the other son of Nifasa, he was also tortured and beaten almost to the point of death. Amina, the next sister of Sayyid Qutb, she was engaged to one of the Ikhwanis while he was in prison. So she was engaged to one of the Ikhwani brothers while he was in prison. And she refused. He said, look, I will divorce you, okay, or I will break this engagement because I'm going to be in prison a very long time. And she said no, and she persisted. And then eventually they got married, and she was 50 years old. She was 50 years old, they eventually got married. But this man, the husband of Amina, he was killed by Anwar Sadat, the tyrant. The third person in the line of Sayyid Qutb was his brother Muhammad. He was still alive today and is in Saudi Arabia. He was imprisoned along with Sayyid Qutb and was tortured almost also until he died. His fourth sister Hamida, her role was to look after the families and the women of the Ikhwan, while many of the Ikhwanis, they were put in prison by the Egyptian government. And she was a link between Sayyid Qutb and the rest of the Ikhwan while he was in prison. And in 1965, she was imprisoned with her brother and given 10 years of hard labor. So you can realize the family and the brothers and sisters that Sayyid Qutb, he grew up with. And if any of this was to happen to our family, that all your brothers and all your sisters that are in prison, you have to ask yourself one question: how many of us would be able to take this? Okay, or how many of us would then, you know, we would panic? But this happened to Sayyid Qutb, but did this deter them, this family, in any way? We will see. If we look at the appearance of Sayyid Qutb, when you read the books of Sayyid Qutb, you expect to see a man who is very revolutionary, and he's a large man, and he's an aggressive man, because his works are quite aggressive. Okay, and they're very, very powerful, the writings of Sayyid Qutb. But many people, upon seeing Sayyid Qutb, and if you've seen his picture, you will be surprised. Okay, you will be surprised at his appearance. One man, when he visited Sayyid Qutb, he said to Sayyid Qutb himself, he said, "I can imagine Sayyid Qutb to look like 1,000 other people except for you." Yeah? Anyone else I could think is Sayyid Qutb, but not you. Yeah? So the picture of Sayyid Qutb is very different. He had a brown complexion and was of medium height and of weak build due to the illness that overtook him in childhood and later in prison. He was a weak man, he was frail. If you look at his picture, you'll see a man who's gaunt, he's thin, right? He's not big and large. And upon meeting him, he was calm and collected and tranquil, not like, you know, the fiery revolutionary type of person that, you know, you'd expect to see when you read his books. If we look at Sayyid Qutb as a child, this is very important, because you realize the kind of tarbiyah that was given to him so that he became the man that he was. Sayyid Qutb as a child would enter the masjids and would read the 5 times prayer in the masjid. And not only this, he would attend the circles of the Azhari scholars. And he would always, as a child, help the poor and the oppressed, just like his father would help the workers in the field. Anyone he saw was poor or oppressed, he would help them and support them and aid them. There was an incident where Sayyid Qutb, he would go to school, and then one day his teacher, his Quran teacher, left the school for an argument. There was an argument between the school, and he went and set up his own madrasa to do hifz of Quran. And Sayyid Qutb's father promised this madrasa teacher that, you know, I will send my son to you. And there was a competition between the school and the madrasa, the hifz madrasa. So Sayyid Qutb, he went to the madrasa to do hifz of Quran, and he found that the teacher wasn't teaching properly, and he found that the students were all messing around, and he was getting no benefit from this. And so he said to his mother that, "I want to go back to my old school." So he went back to his old school, and everyone from the hifz class and the teacher would jeer at those people in the school, because they said that these people, they are not memorizing Quran, they don't know anything about Quran, and, you know, we are memorizing our children Quran, and therefore we are better than them. And Sayyid Qutb, at a young age, he saw this as a challenge, and he said to himself that, "I'll prove to these people in the hifz madrasa that I am able to memorize Quran." And therefore, at the age of 8 years old, he memorized every single year a third of the Quran. He stayed awake until 12 in the night memorizing the Quran, and by 3 years he had memorized the Quran by the age of 11. Sayyid Qutb, as a young age, would also like to be very brave and show to everybody that he's very brave. And one day his mother had taken him to his cousin's house, all to the other end of the village. And she forgot something, she needed something at the other side of the village. And she said, "You know, I need to get something." She was going to go. And Sayyid Qutb, it was in the middle of the night, at the age of 11, he said, "I will go, our mother, don't fear." And it was known that that place was, you know, supposed to be like infested with jinn and things on the way, and it was completely dark and there's no light anywhere. But Sayyid Qutb, he went. On the way, halfway through, suddenly fear overtook Sayyid Qutb, because you know, he found himself in the middle of a dark place, and all the thoughts and ideas and the jinn ideas all came to him, and he stood still. And the man came to see him and rescued him from the situation. And then the man said, "What are you doing out here? Why are you out here in the night?" And he said, "Oh, I'm out here, I'm looking for the jinn. Yeah, I'm looking for them, you know, I want to scare them away." He was a man, as a child, he was very intelligent. And, you know, when he would sit with the scholars of Azhar in their circles, one scholar, he said, would be doing, you know, tafsir of Surah Al-Kahf. He said, just an example. And he reached the ayah, ذَلِكَ مَا كُنَّ نَبْغَ فَارْتَدَّ عَلَىٰ آثَارِهِمْ. Okay? And this word, it should be ذَلِكَ مَا كُنَّ نَبْغِي with a ya at the end. Because and Sayyid Qutb, he said, why has Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said nabgh? Okay? Noon, ba, and ghay without adding the ya. You know why? Because there's no reason for the ya to disappear. There's no, you know, factor like lam or something, like lam, that would mean that the ya goes away. And at a young age, he was asking this question. The Shaykh, he just answered him. They said that this is so Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made it easier for the recitation. To make it easier for the recitation. And he didn't even realize that Sayyid Qutb was the one who asked the question. Sayyid Qutb, at a young age, he would gather his money, his pocket money, whatever he would have, and he would wait for a man called Am Saleh. Am Saleh would visit village to village, and he would have a bookstore with him, you know, a large collection of books, and he would take it to the villages. When Sayyid Qutb would come, Am Saleh, you know, he'd buy books from Am Saleh. Okay, and Am Saleh would have a set of books ready for Sayyid Qutb, okay, to purchase. And if he didn't have the money, Sayyid Qutb would say, "Let me borrow it." Okay, no, I'll have the money, I'll give it to you, the money next time you come. And like this, at a young age, you know, not more than 12, he had his own personal copy collection of 25 books that he bought with his own money. And at that time, yeah, books were not like, you know, cheap now like they are nowadays. Books were expensive. It was an expensive commodity. To have paper and to have books and to have people that were learning and read was an expensive commodity. Yeah? Not like nowadays, you know, you buy a book in £5 or £8 and it's easy. But he had a collection. You can ask how many children today have a collection of books that they have bought with their own money. Okay, 25 books. What would he do with these books? He would imitate the scholars that he'd see, the Azhari scholars. So they were like two books on magic, and he knew that people were very interested in this subject. And what he would do, he would begin to read these books, and he would begin to give lectures to the rest of the village. And because a lot of the women and the children, they didn't have opportunity to go to the masjid, they would call Sayyid Qutb after he finished school to come to their houses and give lectures about these books that he was reading. And he would sit and he would give lectures. But many of the occasions he would be shy and he would refuse to go to the houses of the women while he was a young lad. In 1919, his house, and this is when he was now 13 years old, was a secret meeting point for the revolution. And the revolution in Egypt. And Sayyid Qutb, he would often listen listen to secret meetings, and then later he would go and deliver sermons in the middle of the village about what's happening in the revolution. Sayyid Qutb later moved to Cairo. Now why is it that he moved to Cairo? He was in this village called Musha, and now he moved to this large town called Cairo. His mother was very upset at an incident that his father, because he was very generous on his children, and their inheritance was continuously decreasing. And his father basically spent so much on his children that he had no land left, and even his own house he was forced to sell. He was forced to sell the house and rent property. And his mother was very broken-hearted about this, and she said that she wants Sayyid Qutb to go out and work and then give the money, earn the money, and then buy back the land. So she sent him to Cairo to work and train to become a teacher. She sent him to Cairo. And so therefore Sayyid Qutb, and he went to Cairo, and in 1924 he graduated with a diploma for teaching. But he wasn't happy with this, and he wanted to go into a university called Darul Uloom. Okay, it was one of the most famous universities in Cairo, Darul Uloom. And before you can go to Darul Uloom, you needed to do a 4-year preparatory course. So Sayyid Qutb, he enrolled in this 4-year preparatory course, and then he succeeded in this, and he graduated in 1929, and then he went to Darul Uloom, which he graduated from in 1933, with a first class, okay, what you could call a degree in Arabic language and literature. And while he was studying Arabic language and literature, these are the following units that he studied. Okay, Sharia, Arabic and comparative language, logic, philosophy, history and political economics, as well as other units. So those people that say that Sayyid Qutb, he didn't study Sharia and he didn't have a knowledge of the Sharia, okay, this is a false accusation. And Darul Ulum was a place where if you went there to study Sharia, okay, they would teach you Sharia properly, and was a very respected place. In 1933, after he graduated, he was employed by the Education Ministry. And then in 1940, he was editor and translator for the ministry. 4 years later, however, 1944, he was transferred to the job by the ministry to the role of school inspector, as they were unhappy with his political views. They didn't like his articles that he was writing and the things that he was translating, so therefore they transferred his job to become a school inspector. In 1948, it should be the 1950, not 1952. From 1948 to 1950, he was sent to America to study the methodology of education and teaching. And then as soon as he came back from America in 1950, he resigned from the ministry. Okay, he resigned from the ministry after serving all those years. He resigned from the ministry because he differed with them in their political activities. Sayyid Qutb, however, after having such a Islamic upbringing, there was a time of Jahiliyyah that he lived, his own Jahiliyyah. Okay, he lived his own Jahiliyyah. And there was a time, and this period was lasted 15 years from 1925 to 1940. And basically it was the period when he went to Cairo. When he went to Cairo and was studying in the universities, and went to Cairo and was studying in these high education faculties, this is where he began to read about Western civilization and Western culture, and about, you know, the principles of materialism. And these concepts, they raised severe doubts in his mind about the religion. You know, and that goes to show, if someone like, you know, some brothers, you sometimes see them, they go, you know, to study in these Islamic or these so-called universities where they have like Islamic studies master's course, okay, Islamic studies 3 years course and PhD, and they become very confused after this. They think they're very solid on the religion, but because of the kind of ideas that are being, you know, implanted in them, they become very confused. And if someone like Sayyid Qutb, having such an Islamic upbringing, could become confused by these ideas, it shows that we also should be very careful when tackling these ideas. Sayyid Qutb, he lived in doubt, worry, fear, pain, rebelliousness, and he wanted to know always one thing. He wanted to know what was the secret of life. He wanted to know what was the secret of life. He became so confused he didn't know. And he said about himself that he would often cry and scream and wish death would take him away from the pain and contradiction that he was living. He lost all sense of tranquility and inner peace, and did not know the pure purpose of creation or the wisdom behind the creation of man. And he even recorded all of this period in a selection of poems which he called The Unknown Coast, Ash-Shatih Al-Majhul. And he has described himself as, for example, he is standing on a coast, and he's looking at the sea, and he doesn't know what the sea is, how big it is, what the name of it is, and that sea represented his life, because he didn't know what life was about at that time. How did Sayyid Qutb then begin to become an Islamist? And how did Islam then permeate his life once again? You see, when Sayyid Qutb, he discovered the deen, a complete change overcame him, and he moved to the world, away from the world of ignorance and confusion, and in darkness, to the world of Iman, Islam, work, da'wah and jihad. And he became as if he was a complete new man. And he said, this is my, as if I have been born again. Sayyid Qutb was looking for the secret of life, and he found it. How did his journey begin? His journey started and began when he started to study the Quran in a literal way. He looked at the Quran. His background was always in Arabic literature and language, and he began to study the Quran, okay, in a literal way. And he slowly began to understand the principles underlying this religion. And then something happened to him. Two incidents happened when he went to America. You know, he left Egypt and he went to America. And two incidents happened to him. They were, number one, he says that while he was going to America, he was on the boat, on the ferry to America, and he saw the huge waves and the way the boat was rocking, and at that point he realized the power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he said Iman entered into his heart. He felt Iman actually seeping into his heart. That was the first incident in America. The second incident, he said he was in San Francisco and he climbed a large mountain and he could see the whole of creation in front of him. And he realized the wonder and the beauty of the creation, and he realized the harmony that existed in the creation of Allah and in the universe. And Iman, he said, you know, it hit him. The sweetness of Iman at that point, it hit him. And that they were two incidences in his life that really caused an upheaval in himself. And we can, you know, and after this, he took the Quran as a guide to his life. He used the Quran to help him understand life and the harmony between man and the universe. So he involved himself deeply into the Quran. If we were to look and chart his program as how he became a Muslim and how he became so involved in the deen, there are three steps that we can, you know, look into his life. Three steps towards his Islamization. First step we've already mentioned, it was the literal study of the Quran, and he himself, he formed a project called the New Quran Library Project, in which he would undergo the study of the Quran, the literal study of the Quran. And Sheikh Ali Tantawi at that time, he said about Sayyid Qutb, you know, and the brilliance that he had in understanding the Quran, he said Allah gave him a key by which he opened the treasures of the beauty of the expression in the Quran. This key was not given to any person before him. Sayyid Qutb himself talks about how the Quran affected him. And he says, Al-hayatu fi zilali al-Quran ni'ma. Ni'matun la ya'rifuha illa man zaqaha. Ni'matun tarfa'u al-umar wa tubarikuhu wa tuzakkihi. Walhamdulillah. لقد من الله علي بالحياة في ظلال القرآن فترة من الزمن ذقت فيها من نعمته ما لم أذق قط في حياتي ذقت فيها هذه النعمة التي ترفع العمر وتبارك وتزكي. He said that life in the shade of the Quran is a ni'mah, is a wonderful blessing, a blessing that nobody knows except the person who has tasted it. It increases the life of a person, and it gives them blessing in their life, and it purifies their life. And praise be to Allah, Allah has gifted me with life under the shade of the Quran. A small part of the time, I have tasted in it a blessing which I've never ever tasted the like of before. He talks about his experience with the Quran. And then he not only studied the Quran in a literal sense of way, but that Quran began to impact his ideology and his thinking, and then he began to use what he knew from the Quran in refuting communism and capitalism, ideas that were permeating the Egyptian society at that time. And he wrote many books. A very famous book that he wrote at that time was Al-Adala al-Ijtima'i fi al-Islam. You know, the justice system in Islam. Alright, he wrote, for example, the battle between Islam and capitalism. And thirdly, the third transition in his life was his complete and comprehensive understanding of the religion as a movement towards all aspects of life. And he realized his duty to Allah, his duty to be a witness unto mankind, okay, to spread the religion, he realizes from his works in the Quran, and he realizes that what he has to do for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the life that he has to lead. If we look at his political activity, he was a member of Hizb al-Wahd until 1942, and then after falling out with them, he formed another party called Hizb al-Sa'idin. But after 1945, he refused to work for any political parties and actively called for the rejection of these parties, as none of them worked or served the people. He said all these political parties, they're only there for their own sakes, and they're not doing anything for the people, and he rejected all these parties. He saw that none of these parties, they deserved his zeal or his work or his energy, and he'd rather, he decided to work alone against the political corruption that was prevalent at that time by writing articles and magazines and delivering lectures. And he continued like this until 1953, when he joined Ikhwan al-Muslimin. Now in Egypt in 1952, a revolution took place. A revolution took place in which Jamal Abdel Nasser, okay, the tyrant, he became the leader of the country. And it's important, if we understand Sayyid Qutb, and also if we understand the movement that he was involved in, Ikhwan al-Muslimin, we have to talk a little bit about this revolution. Now, Ikhwan al-Muslimin, the movement, they had a plan in place to cause a revolution. And the plan was to infiltrate the army and to gain officers in the army into the ranks of the Ikhwan. But these officers, they were to form a special group of people. They were not to be directly linked to Ikhwan, but rather they were to be a secret party in Ikhwan. And so they would hold circles for those officers. And they were, those officers, they were to be under the military wing of Ikhwan at that time, under a man called Mahmoud Labib. Mahmoud Labib, he was in charge of the military wing of Ikhwan, and he was directly in charge of giving circles and tarbiyah to those officers that had decided to join their ranks and that the Ikhwan had managed to infiltrate. Two men were most active in this new secret organization of Ikhwan. They were Jamal Abdel Nasser and a man called Abdul Ra'uf. Yes, Jamal Abdel Nasser himself was a member of Ikhwan, and he was a member, a very influential member in the secret military wing of Ikhwan, the officers Ikhwan. And in 1944, the first circle was, they had their first usra, or their first circle, and with five other officers of the army. In 1946, they gave bay'ah to the Nizam al-Khas, you know, the special organization of Ikhwan, which was called the Ikhwan Officers Club. And nobody knew about this, it was secret. Then they agreed to avenge the death of Hassan al-Banna, who had, was killed in 1949 by the Egyptian government. Okay, so, you know, Jamal Abdel Nasser was there, and they agreed that they would avenge the death of Hassan al-Banna, and they also agreed to keep secret the plans to topple the regime. They kept secret that their plans to train the other Ikhwani civilians and to fight the English. And because of security reasons, they changed their name from the Ikhwan Officers Club to the Free Officers, Al-Dubbat Al-Ahrar. It was known as Al-Dubbat Al-Ikhwan, it became Dubbat Al-Ahrar. And then something happened. The secret organization, I said Abdul Nasser and Abdul Ra'uf, they were the most active, but they had a huge split between the two. Abdul Nasser, he wanted to involve other non-Ikhwanis into this secret organization. Whether they're practicing or not practicing, he said, we must get all the army involved and cause a revolution. He wanted to do things very quickly. Okay? And Abdul Ra'uf, he said, no. We will not involve in this organization anyone who, except who is Ikhwan, is practicing and involved Muslim. And this was a split. Then Abdul Ra'uf, he traveled. He traveled, and while he was traveling, the leader of the Ikhwan military wing, Mahmoud Labib, he became ill. And he was on his deathbed, and he didn't know who to give all the secrets of Ikhwan to, and all the documents and the treasury information. There's only one man he could give it to, and that was Abdul Nasser. So Abdul Nasser, while Mahmoud Labib was on his deathbed, was given the secrets, because he trusted in him, of Ikhwan, all the brothers that were involved in the officers' club, the names, the addresses, the treasury, the money that was owed, every single thing was handed down to Abdul Nasser. The secrets of the Free Officers Organization. Now, What is Sayyid Qutb's involvement in this revolution? At that time, Sayyid Qutb was not a member of Ikhwan. He was not a member of Ikhwan. And Sayyid Qutb, like everybody else, he thought that Nasser was a good man and was doing what he was doing to fight corruption and injustice. And the articles of Sayyid Qutb at that time, he was writing articles very heavily in newspapers, in magazines, and this shows the importance of the articles. Why was it that these officers were joining Ikhwan secretly? What was the prime reason? The primary reason was because of the articles of Sayyid Qutb. The officers and in the army, they were deeply affected by these articles. And they were encouraged. The Ikhwan would encourage, although Sayyid Qutb wasn't a member, they would encourage their members, especially those of the free officers, to read his articles. And then many of those officers, including Abdul Nasir, would go to the house of Sayyid Qutb to discuss plans for the revolution. And so Sayyid Qutb, he was seen as the main think tank behind the revolution. You know, he was a think tank. From him, all the ideas were, you know, permeating to the rest of the people that were involved in the revolution. And then in 1950, Abdul Nasir, he left the officers and he formed his own organization with other members of the army. He wanted to involve other members of the army, and like I said, the special branch of Ikhwan, they didn't want to do this, so Abdul Nasir split from them and he involved other members of the army and he formed his own organization for the revolution. Now, although Abdul Nasir, he left the military wing of Ikhwan, he continued to make contact with the da'wah wing of Ikhwan. Now you must realize that the da'wah wing and the military wing, there's very little communication between them, because it was very dangerous if, you know, they find members of the da'wah wing and the plans of the military wing are exposed, it would be very dangerous. And so there was very little communication between the two. So Abdul Nasir could exploit this weakness in communication, and therefore he began to contact the da'wah wing of Ikhwan and began to show his sincerity to them. And at that time, the da'wah wing was under the command, under the Murshid Hassan Hudaybi. And like I said, Abdul Nasir kept on having contacts with them, and he said, look, we will help you, we've got generals, we've got officers, and we'll help your organization, and when we get to power, we'll help us in our aims and objectives. And so Abdul Nasir, he said to the brothers that were helping Abdul Nasir, you know, not the military wing, but those of the da'wah wing, he said that help him on the condition that if he gets to power, he would implement Sharia completely and would be in full cooperation with Ikhwan and would obey them. So if he was to get to power and we were to aid him, if Ikhwan were to aid Abdul Nasir directly, he would, you know, implement Sharia and he would aid them. And the da'wah wing didn't know that the military wing had a split with Abdul Nasir. Yeah? They didn't know this. This was very important information that they didn't know. Then what happened? Abdul Nasir, he took over and, you know, caused the rebellion and the revolution, and by the help of the Ikhwan and on their backs, Abdul Nasir came into power. And then the Ikhwanis, including Hassan Hudaybi, he went to meet Abdul Nasir, and then he reminded him of all the conditions that they had said before. And he was shocked when Abdul Nasir rejected every single condition. He wasn't going to implement Sharia, and he wasn't going to, you know, recognize Ikhwan, he was not going to obey Ikhwan, he was not going to help Ikhwan. Okay? All the promises he had made, he had fallen back on. And then what could Hassan Hudaybi do? This man is now in power and the army is with him. So Hassan Hudaybi said to him, we regard you as a reformist movement. He still saw good in him. If you do good, you do so for the people. If not, we will advise you and we will correct you as Allah wills. After the revolution, Sayyid Qutb, he met with Abdul Nasir. Abdul Nasir still hasn't exposed all his plans. And then he would meet with Abdul Nasir and also the officers sometimes 12 hours a day, you know, formulating plans of how this revolution would become successful. Like I mentioned, Sayyid Qutb was not a member of Ikhwan, and as of yet, he thought the best of Abdul Nasir. And Abdul Nasir, he set up an organization called Tahriri. Okay, he set up an organization called Tahriri. And the reason of this organization was because Ikhwan was very active in the field of da'wah. And Abdul Nasir knew that this was the largest movement around. So Abdul Nasir wanted to form another political organization to counteract and counterbalance Ikhwan. And so he formed this group called Tahrir. And Sayyid Qutb, he didn't realize that this was the plan of Abdul Nasir, and he even helped Abdul Nasir set up this organization. But within one month, Sayyid Qutb, he realized the plans of Abdul Nasir. And he realized that Abdul Nasir set up this new group to counteract Ikhwan, and immediately he resigned from this organization. Nasir, he tried to coax Sayyid Qutb into rejoining the organization, being part of the government. He said, "We'll give you whatever you want. We'll give you the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Culture, the Ministry of Tarbiyah, the Ministry of anything, any position you want, we'll give you, just be with us." But Sayyid Qutb, he refused all these positions and all these offers. Once he realized that Abdul Nasir became corrupt, he refused every single thing. How is it that Sayyid Qutb, he became a member of Ikhwan? How did he become a member of Ikhwan? He said Qutb, he did not personally meet Hassan al-Banna. There are some accounts that he met Hassan al-Banna, but rahmatullahi alayhi, but he personally did not meet him. He knew of his activities before going to America in 1948. While in America, the Ikhwanis, they fought jihad in Palestine, and when they returned, they were all rounded up and put in prison. And he wrote his book, which was called Al-Adala al-Ijtima'iyya. And this book, in the beginning, it says to all the brothers, the mujahids that are fighting in the way of Allah. So a lot of the Ikhwanis, they thought that this book was written for them. And this book was circulated in prison and was widely read by a lot of the Ikhwanis. Although Sayyid Qutb, he was not a member of Ikhwan by then. Imam Hassan al-Banna, when he got a copy of this book, he said, "These are our ideas, and it should be that he is one of us. It should be that he is one of us." Okay? هذه أفكارنا وينبغي أن يكون هو أحد منا. Now, whilst in America, Sayyid Qutb, he got to know of Zionism, and he got to know the hatred that the kuffar had for Islam and the da'wah, especially at that time, the movement of Ikhwan. And then two incidences got him closer to the Ikhwan. The first of these two incidences was when the shahada of Imam Hassan al-Banna. When Hassan al-Banna, he became shaheed and he was killed in America. And one report says Sayyid Qutb, he was in hospital at that time. He was ill. When the news came through the radios and television that Hassan al-Banna had become killed, all the people in the hospital, they cheered and they were in complete jubilation at the death of this man and the shahada of this man. And the newspapers and the articles and all over the television, they're talking about the death of Sayyid Qutb, and they were all up in arms and very happy. The nurses, the doctors, everybody. And Sayyid Qutb, he realized the hatred that these people, they had for Islam. That all of these people are overjoyed because of the death of this man. And also, his contact with an English spy at that time called John Hursden. Now, John Hursden, he was a man who had gone to the Middle East and had learned about Islam and learned Arabic, and he even said he had become a Muslim. And then he even married a Muslim woman. And then he went to America, and he said to Sayyid Qutb, he met Sayyid Qutb, and he said to him, "Your book, Al-Adala al-Ijtima'iyya, okay, this I will translate for you for $10,000. I'll translate for you for $10,000. And then he continued to speak to him about Ikhwan. He had a whole dossier, a full file about the activities of Ikhwan from the beginning they were set up until the death of Imam Hassan al-Banna. They had a full dossier, all the accounts, every activity they did, all the talks, all the lectures, every single thing he had a file of. He knew all the secrets of Ikhwan. And he started to say to him that, forget all your plans and ideas to fight the British. He was a British spy. He goes, this was useless, because if you fight the British and you get rid of them, then America will take their place. So there's no point. Look at the clever way he tried to coax his mind. And then He even said to him, look, you know, forget this organization, this Ikhwan, they are a corrupt organization. As soon as they get to power, they're going to, you know, cause problems. Sayyid Qutb, he realized that this man was a spy and his hatred for Ikhwan, and that's why after coming back, soon after he came back, you know, in 1953, having been affected by the work of Imam Hassan al-Banna, he decided that he will join Ikhwan. He decided that he would join Ikhwan. And at that time, and this is very important, when the time he joined Ikhwan was the time when Jamal Abdul Nasser was fighting Ikhwan and was rounding them up and putting them in prison. SubhanAllah, you know, right at this moment, you know, a lot of the brothers, they are rounded up and put in prison, and every single person they shun away. Oh, I don't want anything to do with the brothers. Yeah? And they shut themselves up in their houses for 6 months, 1 month, you don't see them.
Low profile.
Yeah, they keep a low profile. And at that time, when Ikhwan were being rounded up and put in prison, at that time, Sayyid Qutb, he decides to join them. Not before, but at the time when it's most severe, in 1953. And that reminds us of an incident in the Battle of Uhud. There was a wealthy Jew called Mukhayriq. Mukhayriq was a wealthy Jew. In the Battle of Uhud, he saw Prophet Muhammad ﷺ injured. He saw the Sahaba, many of them had become shaheed. He saw the Muslims had lost the battle. And at that point, when the Muslims were losing, Mukhayriq, suddenly Aqidah entered into him, and Iman entered into his heart. And at that point, he became Muslim. He was a wealthy Jew, and he gave all his money for the sake of Islam. At the point when it was most severe, he decided to become a Muslim. And so Sayyid Qutb was similar. And Sayyid Qutb, he became involved in Ikhwan and began to regularly give the Tuesday dars that they would have, began to publish a weekly newspaper, write articles and lecture from all around. And he also visited like the Syrian branch of Ikhwan and visited other countries and helped spread the ideology. Sayyid Qutb then was imprisoned. And in 15th of January 1954, Ikhwan was dissolved by the government. Yeah. Thousands of Ikhwanis were imprisoned along with their leaders, and Qutb, you know, was also imprisoned. But after huge demonstrations, then they were all released. But Sayyid Qutb, did he say, I was in prison, I better stop my activities? He didn't. He realized even more the hatred that the people had against Islam. He realized the Aqidah, that there is Hizbullah and Hizb al-Shaytan. That's it. There's a party of Allah and there's a party of Shaytan. You can decide which one you want to be in. Okay? And he worked even harder and spread even more articles against the government. And he spread secret documents to expose to the people the true nature of Abdul Nasser and his regime. Then Nasser, he concocted a story that Ikhwan had planned to assassinate him. And as a result, he rounded up thousands and thousands of the Ikhwanis again in October. And this was really the first trial of Ikhwan. This was really the first trial of Ikhwan. And before the trial of Sayyid Qutb in this period, they tortured him and beat him severely. And to the extent what they would do is that before the trial, they made him sit on a chair, you know, for hours and hours and hours and days, and they gave him no food or no drink. And they'd get some water in front of him and they'd pour it in front of him. They do want some water, and they pour the water in front of him. And then before the trial, they made him stand up for 6 hours, and he was already a frail man. He was an ill man. They made him stand up for 6 hours and they'd whip him and they'd beat him. To the extent that, you know, the kind of the illness that overcame him, his lungs were bleeding. Okay? He had rheumatism, he had arthritis. Okay, and he had bronchitis, all the illnesses that you could think of, you know, Sayyid Qutb had, and many of them were intensed by the torture. And when he got up in front of the court, they said to him, you know, you look tired. And he goes, yes, I've been standing up 6 hours before the trial. And at that time, if any of the Ikhwanis spoke about the torture in prison, they would also be tortured. So Sayyid Qutb, to show to everybody that the Ikhwanis were being tortured, he immediately lifted up his back and he showed the number of times that he was whipped. Okay, and this shocked the judges, and he was beaten even more and put in prison. And he was given 15 years of hard labor, of which he served 10 years, and he was, you know, released after 10 years because of his illness and his health. Now in prison, said Qutb was respected by everybody. Even, you know, the worst of criminals respected him. Even the prison guards, they respected him. And he would affect their minds. And he would, when he'd get food from his family, he'd give it and distribute it to the rest of the prisoners. Then afterwards, after he came out of prison, Ikhwan, it was dissolved. And then a man called Abdul Fattah Ismail, he tried to rejuvenate the Jama'ah. And then he spoke to Sayyid Qutb about this. And then Sayyid Qutb, while he was in prison, from 1955 to 1962, 7 years, he planned about, should this organization, you know, should we reorganize this, or, you know, this Jama'ah? And then he realized that he has to do something, because secularism is taking over the society. And then they reorganized the Jama'ah. And Sayyid Qutb, he was leading the Jama'ah while he was in prison. But this time he had new ideas and new plans. The idea was this. He said that he saw that Islamic groups were concentrating too much on a local political level. But the whole of society was in need of reform from the roots. The whole of society was far from understanding the Aqidah. And rather than overthrowing the government, they had to start from the base and let the Islamic society oust the tyrants. In the meantime, it was necessary to train a group of brothers who were solid in the Aqidah and manners and could protect the Jama'ah from oppression. Okay, because he saw what happened to Abdul Nasir. He took over the government, he took over the regime, and he was corrupt. He said, we have to begin from the base, but so that the corrupt people cannot stop our activities, we must have a group of trained brothers that are ready to stop any aggression. And these trained people, what would they do? They would retaliate. If there was any aggression, they would immediately retaliate by killing the Prime Minister, the President, and the Director of Intelligence and the Police. And so Qutb, he began to lead the Ikhwan from prison based on this model. This underground movement of Sayyid Qutb, it was discovered. Okay? It was discovered, accidentally. And suffice it to say that there were infiltrators all around, and the names of the Ikhwan and those who were involved in the Ikhwan, they were given to the people, to Abdul Nasir. And he realized this last issue that I said, the fact that they will aggress and they will fight against anyone who tries to go against them. And in fact, Ikhwan, this was meant to be the last stage. To fight aggression was meant to be the last stage after the society has built up. But what happened is that Ikhwan, they realized that Ikhwan, the secret organization, was going to be found out very soon, and they're going to be hit very soon, and therefore they tried to quickly rush in plans to form this group of people that would be ready to fight any aggression. And there was even a plan that, weapons come from Saudi Arabia and all these things, but this plan, Sayyid Qutb, he rejected after they realized that it was a plan from the secret service to try and accuse Ikhwan and to expose them. Then, in 1965, Abdul Nasir, he announced while he was in Moscow, this shows his links with communism, that Ikhwan was a secret organization and they planned to overthrow him. And then again, many of the Ikhwan, they were put in prison in 1965. This was their second trial, the second trial of Ikhwan. And many of them were tortured in prison. Now, when Sayyid Qutb was asked in an investigation about this new organization and the secret plans and this plan to fight against aggression, in his interview, Sayyid Qutb, he confessed to every single thing. And he admitted everything, and he said about the whole organization. He wanted to take all the blame on his shoulders. That he was leading this new secret underground organization, and he was ready to take all the blame for every single thing. And then also, in front of his interrogators, he admitted to every single act and every single deed, and he took the blame for everything. Now, before being taken to the court for trial, and this was his second imprisonment now. He was released after 10 years, and then again, immediately afterwards, he was imprisoned. The second trial of Sayyid Qutb. He was put in prison before the trial, and it was said that before being taken to the court, like I said, his nephew Rifat was killed directly in front of him. He was beaten to death in front of Sayyid Qutb. Zainab al-Ghazali, she also reports, she was a female member of the Ikhwan, who was also very, you know, beaten in prison. She reports that she went to go to, you know, to relieve herself, go to the toilet, and then she passed by an area in which Sayyid Qutb, you know, was being beaten. And then there was a blanket, there was a, like a cloth, so that he couldn't see outside. And that cloth, some wind came and it raised the cloth, and Sayyid Qutb, he, you know, he caught sight of Zainab al-Ghazali. And then the prison guard, they said, "Oh, look, you raise this cloth yourself." Okay, and they beat him and they whipped him and they whipped him. And she said that, "I was coming back from the toilet and I still heard them beating him, and he was saying that I had no communication with her, I had no plans to talk to her." And they were still beating him. And then it was said that while, you know, the doctors of Sayyid Qutb, because of his condition, you know, his weak lungs, they were bleeding, they had collapsed at one stage. They said, "Look, don't make this man run. Right, when you make him, you know, go from place to place, don't make him run." But the prison guard, they didn't listen to his advice, and they made Sayyid Qutb run from place to place, and they'd whip him, said, "Run, run, run." Okay, and in one of those incidences, he ran, and there and there on the spot, he had a heart attack. Yeah, and he was an old man, you know, he was an old man. He had a heart attack. He was now reaching 60 years of age. And then Sayyid Qutb, he would sometimes see the rest of the Ikhwanis, they were put in prison, and he would go and he would smile at them. He would smile at them, you know, when he'd see them being tortured, and they would say to him that, "We are being tortured, this is a sign of our torture, this way we have been beaten, this way we have been whipped." And then Sayyid Qutb, he would cry and make dua for them. And Sayyid Qutb, he knew that if the Ikhwanis, they spoke about their torture to the rest of the people, to the journalists and things, they would be beaten. So Sayyid Qutb, he took it upon himself to tell the whole world about the torture that the Ikhwan, you know, faced in that time. And therefore he would be beaten even more and even more. There was the trial of Sayyid Qutb. There's a man, a very, you know, like, he was not even a judge. He was a commoner called Fawad Dajawi. This man, Fawad Dajawi, look how much of a coward he was. When he wanted to fight against the Jews in 1956, and the Jews had surrounded him, he joined the Jews against the Muslim brothers. He joined the side of the Jews, and then the Jews let him go. Upon meeting Sayyid Qutb, in the trial, he was a judge. He was very rude to Sayyid Qutb, very rude to him. If you read his account, okay, if any brother knows Arabic, it's in this book, in that whole account of his trial with Sayyid Qutb. He was very, very rude to this man. And Sayyid Qutb, he would look at Dajawi with such a stare of like complete humiliation at this man, and that this man, he had no respect for this man, Dajawi, that this man, Dajawi, he was terrified at the stare and look of Sayyid Qutb. And then, like, just like in the interrogation, Sayyid Qutb took the blame of everything. Said, "Yes, I did this. Yes, we did this. Yes, we did this. And yes, for this reason and for this reason." No, accepted everything. "And this is all our plans. And yes, you are corrupt and disbelieving regime. And these are our plans." Qutb was sentenced. He didn't know what was going to be his sentence, but he knew that it was going to be, he was going to be executed. He knew that his execution was going to be near. And he wrote letters, you know, from his prison. And I just want to, you know, read short passages of his letters, so you know the state of Iman that Sayyid Qutb was living at that time from prison. Oh, subhanAllah, I can't find it, brothers. Khair, man, I can't find it. Maybe
later.
Inshallah, maybe later, inshallah, I'll relate to you the words. They're very moving words, these letters that he wrote, inshallah. You know, human rights organizations and even world leaders, including Malik Faisal, they said that Sayyid Qutb should be pardoned. He should be pardoned, he should release him. Yeah? Because they realized the brilliance of this man. And when Malik Faisal, you know, the king of Saudi Arabia, asked for the execution to be lifted, then Abdul Nasser, he became very angry and he said, "We're going to make the execution happen the next day, in the morning of the Fajr of the next day." And then Throughout that night, Sayyid Qutb, he was, his sister was sent to Sayyid Qutb. You know, his sister Hamida, she was sent to Sayyid Qutb to try and tell him to seek pardon. From Abdul Nasr and all that he did. Okay, it was said to him, "Look, all you have to say is that it wasn't you that were in charge of all this that happened. That all these ideas of revolution and all these plans, this Ikhwan, say some other organization, it was their idea, not the idea of Ikhwan. That's all you have to say. And Sayyid Qutb, he said, in response to this, وَاللَّهِ لَوْ كَانَ هَذَا الْكَلَامُ صَحِيحًا لَقُلْتُهُ وَلَمَا اسْتَطَعَتْ قُوَّةً عَلَى وَجْهِ الْأَرْضِ أَنْ تَمْنَعَنِي مِنْ قَوْلِ. Okay? That if this was the truth, that it was some other organization that had planned all this, and I had nothing to do with this, if this was true, okay, I would have said it, but this is not the truth. This is not the truth. And he said, وَلَكِنَّهُ لَمْ يَحْدُثُ. This is not the way it happened. The way it happened is the way I've said it to you in the trial. Okay? وَإِنِّي لَا أَقُولُ كَذِبًا أَبَدًا. I will not ever say a lie ever. And so they tried many times to go to Sayyid Qutb and seek pardon from Sayyid Qutb, rahmatullahi alayhi. And then Sayyid Qutb had a few things to say to his sister. He said, he said, إن رأيت الوالد المرشد حسن حذيبي فبلغيه عن السلام وقولي له لقد تحمل سيد أقصى ما يحتمله بشر حتى لا تمس بأدنى سوء. He said, because what has happened, Sayyid Qutb is in charge of this underground organization, but Hassan Hudaybi was still really in charge of the whole of Ikhwan, and he didn't want to put any blame on him. He wanted to keep this organization still alive, and therefore he took all the blame. And he said, if you see Hassan Hudaybi, the murshid of Ikhwan, and say to him salam, and say to him that Sayyid Qutb has taken as much punishment that a human can suffer, as much punishment as a human can suffer, and the reason for this is that so that you and the organization as a whole doesn't suffer at all. And then they came to him again at the last point before he was to be executed. They said, oh Sayyid, yeah, just say I'm sorry for what I did, just say sorry, you know, I'm sorry for what I did. And Sayyid Qutb, he said, لن أعتذر عن العمل مع الله. I will never seek any excuse for work for the sake of Allah. I make no excuses for this. This is why I did this, I know why I did this, and I know that with which conviction I did this with. I make no excuses. And when he said to him to write a few words to Abdul Nasir saying, I'm sorry and please, you know, I didn't mean what I was doing, just write a few words to Abdul Nasir, listen to what he said. He said, Inna usba' al-sababa الذي يشهد لله بالوحدانية في الصلاة ليرفض أن يكتب حرفا يقر به حكم الطاغية. He said, indeed, this finger which it witnesses the oneness of Allah in salah, you know, when you say أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله, this finger, it refuses to admit anything that this حكم الطاغي has done, this oppressive regime. It refuses to agree on anything of this oppressive regime. It has nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with it. And therefore, Sayyid Qutb, he was taken to the place of his execution. And when he was taken to the place of his execution, everybody saw him smiling. He had a beaming smile on his face. He was happy, he was smiling, he was waving to the prison guards, and he was very, very happy. Okay, and in one of the letters that I said I'll read, inshallah, he said, I am waiting for this moment. He says, as I remember, that I am living a life I have never ever lived before. I am feeling the true meaning of Iman. I fully understand, you know, the Aqidah, as it's meant to be understood. I fully understand this religion, more than ever before, with a clear vision. And I'm waiting for my Shahada. And I've never ever lived a life better than this life that he was living. Those moments just before his execution. He has had a beaming face on his, and you know, this face obviously was captured on TV and by the cameras. He was very happy to go and meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is what he was waiting for. Because he realized that if somebody works for the sake of Allah, that is going to be his end. That the end result is going to be Shahada. He knew this was the reality of life. And he was expecting it. And then Sayyid Qutb on the 29th of August 1966, okay, with Abdul Fattah Ismail and Muhammad Yusuf Hawash, they were also, you know, members of Ikhwan. They were all hanged, rahmatullah alayhim, rahmatan wasi'a. And on that night, the Ikhwan in the prisons, and it was Jumu'ah, sorry, in the prison they read the surah, وَاتْلُ عَلَيْهِمْ نَبَأَ بَنِي آدَمَ بِالْحَقِّ إِذْ قَرَّبَ قُرْبَانًا فَتُقُبِّلَ مِنْ أَحَدِهِمَا وَلَمْ يُتَقَبَّلْ مِنَ الْآخَرِ قَالَ لَأَخْتُلَنَّكَ قَالَ إِنَّمَا يَتَقَبَّلُ اللَّهُ مِنَ الْمُتَّقِينَ. The story of Habil and Qabil in the Quran, that recited to them the story of the two sons of Adam. Okay? When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accepted the offering of one of them and didn't accept the offering of the other. And one of the brothers said to the other, لَأَقْتُلَنَّكَ, I will kill you. Okay, that I will kill you. And so they read this in Salat al-Jumu'ah, and all of the prison burst into tears when they're reading this. Now Sayyid Qutb, he became shaheed for the ideas that he carried. And he became shaheed, and just like we said yesterday, that when someone becomes shaheed, it means life to the rest of the ummah. And believe you me, the books that Sayyid Qutb wrote, okay, books like Ma'alim fi al-Tariq and Fi Zilal al-Qur'an and Al-Adal al-Ijtima'iyya, these books were banned. But they influenced society. It was said in the universities when these books were banned, the students, they would write these books with their own hands. Under candles, they would write the books with their own hands to keep a copy of these books. And these books, they permeated, you know, the minds of the Muslims. And so any Muslim that you see has a comprehensive understanding of the religion, and understands the aqidah, and understands the fight between, you know, al-haq and batil, and understand why we are here, and our role on this earth. Okay? And the leaders of the Mujahideen, most of these people, you will see, they will say that they have read milestones, and when they read milestones, Ma'alim fi al-Tariq, when they read this book, they were influenced. And when they read Fi Dilal al-Quran, this is when they started to change. They started to understand the deen as it should be understood. Okay, so, you know, the person, he became shaheed and he met Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but his ideas live on. أقول قولي هذا أستغفر الله لي ولكم وجزاكم الله خير حسن الاستماع.